Today's program is brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cain5.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 69 in the series that we have been putting together here. For the last handful of episodes, I've had my producer, Anne, in the studio with me. Anne is out today. She has some family stuff to attend to, so I am flying solo with Jack. Hi, Jack.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good.
Jack, have you been following this Brian Williams story?
I have.
What do you think about it?
Man, it's tough. I kind of feel for him a little bit. Part of me that feels for him. But then again, it's pretty, it does break journalistic integrity in a pretty real way.
I 99% feel for him. And I feel like...
you're 99% on his side.
I'm on his side. So yeah. Here's the thing. I have platforms on a small scale. I have my radio show, Sharp and Hot, subscribe on iTunes, and I have my classrooms, and I have the occasional other event that I participate in. I did presentation party night and verbal fight club this week, which were super fun. And when you are a professional entertainer in whatever your field is, your job is to be a storyteller. And I think that in his case, there's been an overlap that he let spin out of control a little bit. And I feel for him. And I feel like it's the kind of thing, there's a social experiment you can do where you promise, where you're not going to lie for an entire day. And almost no one can do it. Because everyone is, saying just a little, oh, it's just easier if I just say I was on the phone. Or I was in the shower. Or whatever it is.
Right.
And in his case, I feel like it's just that amplified by his position and his platform and his desire to entertain. And I don't even know that he's lying about, I can totally see, and if something happened very dramatic to me or around me at some point in my history, and then someone asks me about it, I could see myself in his position, and I not for any malice or any trying to promote my career or my platform or whatever it is, but I just makes me cringe to watch him come undone in the public eye.
I don't think he had bad intentions. That's what I'm... I don't think he, intentionally fabricated to make himself look better or anything like that. We've all had stories that kind of change over the years as you tell them, right?
And they get better, and they get more interesting. I used to have a pin on my backpack when I was in high school that my mother gave me that said, never let reality spoil a good story.
I mean, to play devil's advocate, though, we're also not NBC news anchors.
No, and that's true.
And it's a different set of rules and a different code of conduct that you have to follow, I think.
And pay grade.
For real, yeah, totally.
Right, and so there are, a line of people that want to be behind him who would take his seat with greater integrity. And I feel for the guy.
Yep.
So at the Verbal Fight Club, which shout out to all of the people who came to Brooklyn Brewery on Thursday night. I had so much fun. The fight was about whether or not it's ethical to eat meat. And while there wasn't a declared winner, it was obviously me. The argument was made essentially that eating meat is unnecessary. And the person making that argument to me while we're standing on stage was drinking beer. And I said, well, so is beer. And the audience approved heartily. But I was in a very friendly, omnivorous crowd. But there was a moment where I was standing on stage and I said something that even as I was saying it, it was a part of a different story. So what happened was people were talking. The question came about whether or not it was ethical to eat bugs. And if we're going to draw a line between meat and bugs, where's that line? And is it arbitrary? Is it ethical? And I said, I would eat my dog before I ate a bug. Now, that's not true. And the joke is I use that line when I talk about eating eels. I hate eels, and eels are absolutely horrifying, and I literally would eat my dog before I ate an eel. But because I was on stage, and because I knew it was funny, and because there were people listening to me, I used that line, realizing that anyone who was paying attention would call me out on it because we use bugs in so many food colorings, even natural ones. So I had to correct myself on stage, and that's what got me thinking about Brian Williams. Like, I did it. It just wasn't as bad because I'm not talking about something that's so much more loaded. But I was called there as an expert, and I wasn't entirely accurate. So I feel for Brian Williams. I also love his daughter. I liked Peter Pan. I might have been the one person. But I'm easy to please in that department. It made my kid happy. Speaking of which, a shout out to my husband, who I believe is listening right now, who is home with our child, who has his first kid stomach upset. And I'm not going to go into any other detail than to say that I love my husband and what he has overcome in his desire to stay free of germs is really heroic. And I appreciate everything that he is doing with our child, who was supposed to start preschool, but we have kicked that can down the road by a week. So, Mark, I love you and I appreciate it. Okay, so my first guest is going to join us by phone. Right, Jack? We have our guest on the line. Excellent. Carol Morrison is a chicken farmer who is part of a barn raiser project. And while Ann and I have made a commitment to shifting our point of view to guests who can join us in the studio, I will always, always make room for barn raiser guests because I really love what they're doing. So Carol is going to join us now. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
How are you? Welcome to Sharp and Hot.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I don't know if Ann told you this, but I am also a small, very small-scale chicken farmer.
Ah, so you know what I'm doing.
I know what you're doing. And so will you give the listeners your sort of backstory and what has brought you up until this point?
Well, for 23 years, we've raised chickens under contract in the industrial model for a multinational company here on the Delmarva Peninsula. After I allowed the filmmakers from Food Inc. in on the farm and opened the doors up to show what the industrial system was like, needless to say, the industry wasn't very happy about it. A few months later, our contract was terminated, and we were left with two 500 by 40 feet barns. It's 20,000 square feet apiece and nothing to do with them. So for about 3 years, we left the barns empty. I had the opportunity to go around the country and see different types of farming, I mean, all kinds of farming. And, you know, I'd come back home and I'd be cutting the grass, you know, talking about 13 acres of grass that I had to cut. And I'm thinking the whole time, you know, we really need to do something here because I'm tired of cutting grass. So it kind of evolved into the pasture-raised hens. We are animal welfare approved certified. And with their help, you know, a lot of technical assistance because we had raised meat birds. We had no clue about anything. So it was all a learning experience as far as that went. Pasture-raised hens are a lot different than confined industrial chickens.
How would you describe some of their sort of basic differences?
Oh, Lord. Well, number one is the amount of animals. When we were raising industrially, we raised 54,400 chickens every 7 weeks. Now we have 1,200 hens on pasture. So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, I mean, it's totally different as far as the animals are concerned. We use traditional breeds. We have the Rhode Island Reds, Barred Rocks, and Delawares, where with the industrial chickens, I mean, they are mixed and matched in genetics to perform. You know, for certain traits that they want. And those chickens, you know, all they did was stay inside of a chicken house, you know, crammed in, and they would eat and drink, and they could take a few steps and plop down. That was about, you know, all they did for they're very short life. These hens here that we have, they run in and out as they please. They, you know, fly, they flap their wings, dust bathe, do all kinds of things, like chickens.
Right.
You know, so that's totally different. The environmental, aspect of it is rewarding to me because I knew the amount of manure the industrial chickens were producing. And it still is a huge issue for the Chesapeake Bay. With these hens here, we have, 1,200 hens on 14 acres. So we have, very few animals to contribute to any type of runoff problem. So that was a big plus for me personally.
Right. When you opened the doors to the Food Inc. crew, did you see the reaction coming, or were you caught off guard by losing your contract?
Oh, no. Prior to that, I had been fairly vocal about the industry. I had this crazy idea in my head that, if you raised enough cane about it that, something might change. But then I finally realized it's just not going to change.
Right. Yeah.
It was not a surprise. I fully expected it. Now, the official reasoning is that we refused to upgrade the two poultry houses for upgrades that were demanded by the company. So they had a legal reason, that was their reason for terminating our contract.
But you were was there a sense of relief that you were free of the obligation to them now that you have set out on your own?
Actually, it was like a big weight lifted off my shoulders.
Right.
At first, it took me a few weeks because I'd walk out the door and I'd think that I was doing something wrong. I had forgotten something because I had been so used to, going and to the chicken houses all the time, and I was free. I didn't have to worry about it anymore.
Right.
And we knew, we expected that it would come, so it wasn't really a big surprise.
So that brings us to you are now in your own operation, and there's a video on the Barn Raiser site where you are hand washing your eggs. Now, I only have 14 chickens, and hand washing the eggs is a chore.
Yeah, so, it's a chore.
So are you're washing the eggs of 1,200 birds by hand right now?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I wash, grade, and pack by hand. All of our eggs go to Whole Foods.
Okay. And how many people do you have working with you?
Just myself and my husband and son. They both work full-time jobs, so, when they have time, they help out.
So what are you looking to do with the Barn Raiser project? What are some of the upgrades? For those
project is really, it has different reasons. Of course, the upgrades in the infrastructure, we want to expand the flock here on the farm and put in, of course, a room. We're going to utilize one of the ends of the poultry barns that's empty. We're trying to recycle here. Put in the egg washing machine and the packaging and whatnot so that it's all in one place and we can distribute from it. The other part of it is the region that I come from is totally dominated by industrial chicken production. Farmers don't see any options in what they do. So by doing this, it offers a choice and, a solution to the problem. So showing that it can be sustainable. And you can make a business out of it. Hopefully it will, plant some seeds for other farmers.
That's really, really awesome way of thinking about it. I hadn't thought of it that way. And it's funny that you mentioned the grass. We are actually my husband and I are going to raise some meat birds this summer because we have so much grass. We're going to build a very small hand-powered chicken tractor to move around so that it's a part of the yard we don't have to mow anymore, but exactly the same reasoning.
it gets tiresome.
It's exhausting. And you know, if you have ever ridden on a ride-on mower and you have some time to think about the amount of time and get resources, gasoline that you and what you're putting out of the back of this machine, it's like there's got to be a better use for this backyard.
Oh yeah, definitely. And we have plenty of acreage here, and just to cut the grass, it is. It's a waste of time, number one. And, of course, the fuel and whatnot, you know, you can put it to better use.
Right, right. So the website is, I just tweeted it, so people can, if you go to Chef Emily P, you can see the link to the Barn Raiser site. And the campaign is open for another 18 days. There was a question that I wanted to ask you that I complete. Oh, I know. Can I ask you for a piece of advice as someone who wants to sustainably raise meat birds?
Sure.
First of all, is that an oxymoron? I mean, my goal is to know where my food is coming from as best as I can. So we have this space and I want to do it. But in the catalog from which one orders baby chicks, which will be sent in the mail for listeners who have never thought about where chickens come from, we use a hatchery. And they literally show up in the mail, you know, the people at the mail post office call me and say, lady, your chicks are here. And usually they're very cute and like, oh, your chicks are here. When you order honeybees, which come the same way and the box is buzzing, they're much less patient.
But we got turkeys that way this year too.
Right. I mean, and it's fascinating when you get this catalog and you can order mallards for your backyard if you want them.
Yes.
But
yes,
so the options are the Cornish cross, which is what people are generally eating if they're getting their chicken in the industrial food system.
Yeah, that's
right?
An industrial breed.
And then the option is for something called a Pioneer. Have you heard of this breed?
No.
So they look like a Rhode Island Red, and they take about 12 weeks to from, you know, when you get them to harvest. And so everything that I know about the Cornish crosses is that they will drown in the rain before they'll walk 5 steps to go underneath something to keep them dry.
And not only that, they grow too fast for it's really not good for their bones and internal organs to have a really rapid growth rate.
Right.
So you want a slower growing bird. The one that I'm familiar with, and I've heard a lot of good things about, it's a Freedom Ranger.
Oh,
and
yeah, yep.
There is a hatchery in Pennsylvania that sells them.
All right, I have made a note, because I think if we're going to do this seriously, getting the Cornish crosses is kind of defeating the purpose if I'm contributing to the supply and demand chain, even at the chick level.
Well, definitely. You know, one of the biggest things here was the difference in the animal welfare approved certification and the way the animals are treated, the way they're raised. You know, you don't just stress them out to get something out of them.
Right, right.
So it all depends on what you want to do, but I find it rewarding.
Carol, thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot. We're going to share all of this information on the website, and the Heritage Radio team will also share it. I wish you the best of luck with your campaign and with your girls.
Well, thank you.
Have a great day. When we come back after the break, I am going to be joined by the folks from Edible Impacts.
And the break song today is called Anxieties by The Landing. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Kane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to kane5.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joining me now in the studio are Alex and Brooke, who have started a project called Edible Impacts, that they are here to talk to us about eating at the low-income line. And interestingly, the segue from the past segment into your segment is the connection of Whole Foods, because we were talking about that off-air. I'm going to let you guys sort of set up the project. What brought you to it? What's your background? And then I'll ask you some questions. But it's really fascinating. You're going to do a way better job of explaining it than I am.
Cool. Well, I'm Alex, and the campaign was called 30 Days to Shine, which was 30 days eating on a low-income budget and a commitment to eat all organic whole foods, so real foods that's no processed, only organic produce. So a specific list of foods also that would fit within that budget based on the season. So no tomatoes was one that we couldn't do.
And not canned tomatoes because they came in a package? So
exactly.
You would have to have canned them yourself if you were planning for this project.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So, like I said, a low-income budget, which for me as a male, we follow the USDA numbers. So I was between $6 and $7, and Brooke was between $5 and $6.
Do you know where the USDA gets that number? Like, how did they come to that number, those two numbers for men and women?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how they came up with those numbers. I know that based on some low-income cost evaluation for male and female, they came up with those. I know the SNAP, there's a SNAP challenge as well. That number is upwards of the $4 per day. So we were a little bit higher than that. But I think what we did also spoke volumes a little bit more. And the difference also was that with the SNAP challenge, it talks about how hard it is and how people can't do it. But the goal that we had is really saying, hey, it is possible. Truthfully, this is something that we are doing every day. This is our lifestyle. This is our diet. So ultimately, we're just documenting it for the public.
So, Brooke, what was it that had you like, okay, let's make this a hashtag. Like, let's make this real. Like, was it over beer one night? You were like, let's do it. Like, let's commit to doing it.
Well, we originally were working on a different campaign for our company, Edible Impacts, and just kept coming across this idea that there's certain perceptions out there that people have around food. One common one that we kept running into was that organic food is kind of a luxury good, over-the-top expensive and unaffordable, along with...
Okay, wait, you know, can I stop you there?
Mm-hmm.
Prove that myth wrong.
Well, I don't believe that. I mean, looking at it comparatively to unorganic food, it definitely is more expensive. There's no argument there, but we really wanted to set out to prove that it is affordable for people on a low-income budget and a middle-income budget as well. So we're not saying that it's not cheaper than conventional food. It definitely is more expensive, but just wanted to change the perception and thinking that it's, you know, an elitist luxury.
I asked you that. I wanted to put you on the spot intentionally.
No, that's
and I
great.
Should have warned you.
No,
but but that's been my experience. Is that out of hand? People say, "Oh, it's so much more expensive," and it's like, yes. But it's not inaccessible expensive.
Right.
It is
exactly.
Like when you look at the raspberries next to each other, sure, they're more expensive, but still affordable on the budget of. So what are some of the things that you, what were some of the common things that you ate or some of like, what were the challenges? And you said that this is your regular lifestyle, right?
Yeah, definitely. We try to eat mostly whole foods that haven't been processed or packaged. But yeah, we ate a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. We shopped mostly in the bulk section for beans and rice and different legumes and grains, and tried a bunch of different cool stuff. We did get to try some new foods that we hadn't ever even had before, which was really cool.
Like what? What's an example?
Like amaranth.
Oh, yeah.
We made some cool amaranth
dishes. I became obsessed with millet.
We realized we could do a lot of different things with millet. We made like a pizza crust out of millet, which was cool. It was mostly a plant-based diet, so no meat and eggs and dairy.
Did you know that going in, or did you come to that realization based on your dollars?
We had an idea going in that it wouldn't be possible. We knew it is possible to some extent. We haven't budgeted for that if we included eggs or dairy into our diet. But we really wanted to show that it is possible on a plant-based diet, mm-hmm. And especially meeting the nutrition needs for someone that is low income. I don't think that they would consider this an option at all, mm-hmm. Especially since I think commonly people associate your diet with non-plant-based foods, so, you know, meat, obviously. So it was a way for us really to open up that idea. And then one thing that we did was not make it very obvious that it's a plant-based diet, because I think what happens is when somebody comes and they instantly see that, it takes away from their openness, and then they're not as curious anymore to delve into it.
I feel like it's like a dad thing, and I don't mean this like my dad or anyone's dad in particular, but I just have this idea that dads eat steak, you know, like dads don't want
my dad does.
Yeah, and so it's this idea, and I think it's of a certain generation, because I would say my husband is growing out of that, but there is a certain amount of like, there's got to be meat on the table, like there has to be meat on your plate. And what I've like spent a lot of my time trying to do is get people to think of meat as a garnish. I mean, it's it's me and Michelle Obama. It's not a unique thing. But like, load your plate up of vegetables and then have a small amount of meat, but that it doesn't have to overtake your entire plate, mm-hmm. where you're like sizzler steaks hanging off the sides of your plate. And then mm-hmm. we look at the, you know, epidemics that grow out of that lifestyle anyway. And it's like, so in your case, you're proving that it can be done even while shopping at Whole Foods, which I love because I love Whole Foods. They are a sponsor of the radio station, but I love them, and I think that they're really trying to do the right thing by a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so now you've given this sort of like, you can do it. Just take away the obnoxious reaction, I feel like. It's like, because I said off air, you're like, oh, right. People say it's whole paycheck. But that's because people like me go into the cheese and chocolate aisle, and then I end up spending $200 where I was like, I only went in there for some fruit. What happened? And I can't blame Whole Foods for that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So on the website, you have the 30 Days to Shine hashtag. And are you asking, is there a call to action that people do the same project that you've done?
Yeah, I think so. Ultimately, we really want people to get on board and try this for 30 days. We have a manual available for people to go on and kind of see everything from what recipes are, what do I buy, how do I do this? Because the biggest question is, how do I even begin making this choice, and what do I buy in the store? Or if I only have to shop at Whole Foods, because we didn't want to discriminate anybody from being able to do
this.
So,
I know you have the nutrition information posted with each of the recipes. Do you have the amount of time that it takes to prepare things? Because I think that's another misconception is that,
definitely,
oh, it's going to take so long if I have to cook everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah, we have times, and we have certain recipes that are, you know, 10 to 20 minutes, and then longer ones as well for special occasions or just if you feel like taking on a more greater challenge in the kitchen. But yeah, we definitely want to set out to address the time perception with regards to cooking. You know, we understand the time commitment to making, you know, all your food 100% of the time, but definitely think there's space to incorporate maybe one or two meals a week to start that are cooked, and then, you know, see what that's like, because it doesn't have to be so extreme where it's like, well, I have absolutely no time to cook. It could be, you know, just starting to get your feet wet and understanding that it might not be as daunting as it may seem.
I think that's a real part of it, is like, it's a personality type thing. Like, there are some people who are like, I'm going to do meatless Monday because that's approachable. And then there are other people who are like, I'm going to do 30 days without X, Y, and Z because that's something different. I want to say I'm in the first camp, but I think I'm in the second camp. Like, I need to like give myself a challenge. Like, I signed up for a half marathon this week.
Oh my goodness.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
It was actually a little bit earlier than this weekend, but yes, it's in April, and now it's like, I can see the days getting longer and I can see it coming, but like I had to commit to something.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was like, I'm just going to run one day a week, I would never go
right.
So you have another project that you mentioned. We're almost out of time, but I want to give you a second to talk about your brand new podcast, which I think is a novel and funny and brilliant idea. And I hope you'll invite me on to be a guest. So
definitely.
Go ahead and talk about it.
So it's called Fruit Catch Friday, and it was born in the kitchen of all places. We were just throwing fruit back and forth, and it's really just a podcast of us talking about different topics Alex and I find interesting. And when one of us drops the fruit, that means you have to change the topic. So yeah, it's really fun. You can listen in. It will be posted on our website at edibleimpacts.com. So
I think that that's like, it's, I could see Marc Maron throwing fruit. Like, it's just so simple and yet so funny and elegant.
Cool.
Thank you for coming on Sharp and Hot. We have another guest whose name is escaping me, not this week. That's you guys. Next week is going to be Sal Rizzo, who runs the Degustibus Cooking School at Macy's. Many people don't even know there is a cooking school in Macy's, but they have some of the world's best chefs come through there, and people come and eat and watch them cook. He's next week. The following week, another graduate of the NYU Food Studies program has done a similar project with eating under a certain dollar value every day. I envy you guys' commitment. I envy your ability to pull this off. I don't know that I could do it. I don't spend money on shoes and bags and things, but I don't blink twice about dropping money on food. And if I had to rein myself in, I would learn a lot, I think, about myself and about how much of the population that I share my planet live as well. So thank you for shedding light on it in a very eloquent way. I will also plug my friend Andy and Rajmi's film Eating Alabama, which was a similar project where they committed to only eat food from Alabama for a year. And so it ended up becoming a James Beard awarded film, but a similar kind of like, let's see what happens. And right. I really like that method of like changing the world a little bit at a time. I feel like there was another question that I had that I was like, oh, let's save that for on air. And now I can't remember what it was. I don't think I wrote it down. This is what happens when Anne's not here. Anne, I love you. I can't wait to see you next Tuesday. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to Sharp and Hot. Thanks to my guests for coming out to Bushwick. I hope you stay and have pizza at Roberta's if you have the time. It's really good. And their unsung thing on the menu is the burger. I don't know if that's on your what you're eating right now, but it's really, really good. Next week is Sal Rizzo. He will be in the studio with us talking about the relaunch of the Degustibus Cooking School. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. That way you don't have to think about when you're going to listen to the show. It will be automatically delivered straight into your iPhone and you can just hit play. I was talking to Allison, the deputy director and past and often guest of Sharp and Hot, about how I come to listen to podcasts and when I decide to listen to them. And it's usually because someone I know recommends them to me. And then I think about how long I'm going to be in my car. And then I find something that's about 30 minutes long and I hit play. Sharp and Hot fits both of those things. I like you. Listen to my podcast. Until next week, everyone, keep playing with fire and knives.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.